From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 1 year ago this week, Superstorm Sandy plowed into the eastern seaboard, flooding, pounding, astounding a whole region, New York City and far beyond. In its aftermath, Sandy also brought a new urgency to the discussion of how to slow climate change and protect ourselves against its consequences, how to dig in and how to dig out. This hour on Point, 1 year after Superstorm Sandy, tackling climate change in the atmosphere and on the ground. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did Sandy make it real to you? Or was there something even closer to home, your home? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from New York, it was Epicenter, is Matt Sherman, editor at WNYC, who's been closely following the rebuilding and reinforcement efforts in New York and beyond. Matt, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Take us back to this day a year ago. You must have been in the thick of it there. Your reporter's out. Water's flooding all over the place in Lower Manhattan. Hospitals being evacuated. I mean, this was really like nothing else we've seen there.
Yeah, there was a small crew of reporters and editors here at the station. We're actually not too far from the Hudson River. And they were shacked up in hotels that were just like a block or so away. And just getting across the street was tough that night. But we managed through it. We actually had the power went out for most of Lower Manhattan where we are. And fortunately, our generator clicked on. We were able to stay on the air. At first, it was really hard to say just how bad the damage was. The idea of a hurricane hitting New York City, a major hurricane, and technically, you know, this wasn't actually a hurricane by the time it reached us, was so unbelievable, even though it was certainly within the realm of possibility that people had a hard time believing it. Once it happened, I remember people calling into our shows in the evening, describing fireworks displays across the East River because the transformers in a major power substation there basically had flooded and started to explode. And it wasn't until much later that we really understood how deep the devastation was, how many people died, 44 in New York City alone, and how long it will take us to rebuild.
Up and down that coast, just an enormous storm pushing all that water into New Jersey, New York, dropped 3 feet of snow in West Virginia, brought 20-foot waves in the Great Lakes in the Midwest, registered all kinds of records, at least 182 deaths in total, $65 billion in damage in the United States, the second costliest weather disaster in American history, behind only Hurricane Katrina. So where does the rebuilding stand and the reimagining of the shoreline stand, Matthew, today?
I would say that there's been lots of planning, lots of thinking going on. The actual rebuilding on the ground has been pretty slow. That's not to be that's not unexpected. It really takes a long time.
We saw it with Katrina as well.
Yes, exactly. So people are just beginning to rebuild. I know of some private landlords who own office buildings in Lower Manhattan who've taken matters into their own hands. They've erected or they've bought floodgates, temporary floodgates that they can store in the basement and bring up when there's a hurricane warning just around their building, at least to protect their own property. The Army Corps, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, has been dumping more sand back on the beaches to replenish that which was lost during Sandy. Mm-hmm. But in terms of really reimagining, there's been a lot of imagining going on, but in terms of actually building walls or levees or taking other measures that will really prevent the same type of damage from occurring in the future, that's still at least a few months, maybe a few years, in some places, decades.
We're reading about this competition, 41 ideas that have been pitched for a more resilient coastline along that whole great area there. Rockefeller Foundation President Judith Rodin saying it's part of an effort to revolutionize how coastal communities are planned, with an eye out for more storms like this, rising waters. I know one of them is an 8 mile, I think, plan for walls that would be sort of disguised as artworks and public facilities, but all around that area. Others looking on out to 2080, looking at the Jersey Shore, saying you may need water taxis instead of bridges to get from place to place. You may have amusement parks on barges rather than piers. What about this idea of major armaments along the shore of New York, New Jersey, and beyond? Where's that stand?
Still very early in the planning stages. Actually, in a way, many of these proposals, not quite as extravagant as what you laid out there, but in the 50s, there were a number of hurricanes that came very close to New York and also did a lot of damage, actually up and down the eastern seaboard. And the Army Corps of Engineers actually embarked on a national effort to try to make our shoreline more resilient. A few things, but only a very few things, actually got done at that point. They had imagined seawalls along the Rockaways, along Staten Island, which 50 years later in Sandy were hit really hard. Seawalls that would have prevented a lot, if not all, of that damage from happening. But we lost interest in that. We lost the will to fund those projects, and they went nowhere. So the Army Corps is actually probably going to be the agency that would do this really heavy lifting to protect the coast. Mm-hmm. They are engaged in a number of new studies, to some degree based on their old studies. They're expediting those studies. They have more money now, thanks to the federal Sandy Aid bill that was passed by Congress last January. But even that is still years away from actually happening.
And what about the New York State Legislature? In the West, and we'll hear more about this, we've heard about California, Oregon, Washington, up into British Columbia, making their own kind of regional plans on climate change, whether it's on adapting the coast to make it more resilient, strengthen it, or to actually respond to climate change itself, atmospherically and beyond. Have there been initiatives in the wake of Sandy in, let's say, the New York State Legislature, Matthew?
They haven't really taken place in the legislature. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, has organized some commissions that came out with reports. And the governor is also figuring out ways to spend the federal Sandy Aid money. The city's mayor, Michael Bloomberg, is also doing that here in New York. And in a way, actually, Bloomberg has gotten farther in laying out what his vision is. But I would say even at that level, we're talking about plans. We're saying we have to study climate change. We have to make a decision at some point how high our buildings have to go above flood level. So if we build them today, they will not only be high enough to withstand a 1-in-100-year flood today, but a 1-in-100-year flood 70 years from now, when sea levels are expected to have risen 2 to 4 more feet. So we're talking about elevating buildings much higher than they currently are. And that's going to take a lot of willpower that has economic consequences. And so people at this point are simply saying, we have to look at this.
Some are studying, some are moving. We're going to look at both in this hour, on the ground and in the atmosphere. Matthew Sherman is editor at WNYC in New York. Matt, thank you very much for being with us today. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom.
A year ago, here was a resident in Sayreville, New Jersey, got very emotional talking with New Jersey Governor Republican Chris Christie just a few days after Superstorm Sandy, talking about the damage to her home, her neighborhood.
All ruined down here. Yeah. Every ounce of it ruined. Yeah. Nothing. 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 It's a shame. It's a shame.
It was a wallop. And it's not only walloping, of course, on the eastern seaboard. Look around the world. Here was a report just this week from Harbin, China. Smog there so bad, only 50 yards visibility. Here was Gloria Riviera for ABC News, October 21st.
It is air so toxic, so thick with pollution, it's hard to make out the person next to you. Harbin, China, a metropolis home to more people than live in the entire state of New Jersey, frozen in a soup. On the roads, it's hard to even make out red from green traffic lights. Warnings to stay indoors. For those venturing out, a mask is the only defense.
What will we do about it? Well, we'll see. Here was President Obama in his State of the Union address in February.
We can choose to believe that Superstorm Sandy and the most severe drought in decades and the worst wildfires some states have ever seen were all just a freak coincidence. Or we can choose to believe in the overwhelming judgment of science and act before it's too late.
Let's bring in a couple of big thinkers on climate change and how to tackle it, what we're doing, what we're not. From San Francisco, Kate Gordon joins us, VP, Director of the Energy and Climate Program at Next Generation, think tank out there. She's also Executive Director of Risky Business. It's a new project that looks at the economic risks posed by climate change, started by New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, hedge fund guy turned environmental activist Tom Steyer. Kate Gordon, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Stanford, California, Mark Jacobson is here, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University, where he's also director of the Atmosphere Energy Program, co-founder of the Solutions Project, which promotes a push for 100% reliance on renewable energy. Mark Jacobson, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me here.
Kate, we've just got a minute before the break, and then we'll dive all the way in. But did Sandy ring the bell in your world, in the wider world? Do you see a change in thinking about resiliency, about tackling climate change causes themselves, that's grown in the wake of this monster storm?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, your top of the hour really highlighted this. We, of course, cities and states have been responding to extreme weather for decades, but what we're really seeing post-Sandy is a shift to finally accepting the climate change science and starting to think about understanding the long-term risks, not just immediate reaction and resilience, but also how do we start to think about planning forward 5-50 years into the future to really deal with the long-term risks of climate change.
Mark Jacobson, we've just got a second before the break. We'll dive on in, but are our ears wider open to your full renewable plan now?
More and more people are listening to it, but we have a long way to go.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking about tackling climate change this hour, 1 year after Superstorm Sandy, talking about changes on the ground, adaptation to threats that towns, cities, states, whole regions are looking at, and changes in the way we live to address climate change itself. Kate Gordon joins us from San Francisco. She's there with Next Generation, the think tank, and executive director of Risky Business. It's a new project looking at all this through an economic lens, looking at economic risks posed by climate change and responses that they suggest, demand. Mark Jacobson is with us from Stanford University. He is co-founder of the Solutions Project, pushing for 100% reliance on renewable energy in the not-so-distant future. Right in the path of the storm, still a lot of confusion and dislocation about what's going on, what's going to happen. Fox News talked with Gigi Dore on Union Beach, New Jersey this week. Her restaurant, Jacobob's, was destroyed by Superstorm Sandy. She got $9,000 from her $1 million insurance plan.
If I don't know where I'm going to be next year, I would hope that we're driving pilings up the road and we're back into business and everything is good. We're serving nice cold drinks on the tiki bar and that shrimp cocktail is going out real good. I don't know.
Where she's going to be, she doesn't know. Some are moving. California Governor Jerry Brown was talking here Monday about a new pact between California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, expand the use of cleaner fuels. Federal government maybe not acting fast enough for them. The region is moving. Here's Jerry Brown.
Many, many steps need to be taken. And as we tie together all these initiatives, we begin to chip away at carbon emissions.
Kate Gordon, on which front does it look to you like we're doing better or more or acting more realistically? On the adaptation front, building up defenses, preparing for what may be coming at us? Or on the, you know, sort of changing our energy use and emissions front in ways that might actually draw down climate change?
Well, you know, it's always easier in some ways psychologically to work on the short term than the long term. I think it's, again, cities in particular have been at the front lines of just reacting and adapting to extreme weather events for decades. Those events have increased fourfold in the last couple of years, and they will continue to increase, the science shows us, with climate change. So what we've been doing is a lot of adaptation, probably enough. We're starting to do more resiliency, building up a little more proactively to deal with some of those storms. But what we need to be doing and what the Risky Business Project is really about is thinking long term, is doing what we do in other sectors, health insurance, the national security sector, looking at threat assessments, looking at long term risk and saying, OK, what's the probability of these extreme events? What's the probability that climate change will have a massive impact all across the country? And how do we think about actually being proactive in reducing that risk? So that's really what we're starting to look at now and I think is critically needed, is that proactive sort of actually mitigating or dealing with the long-term effects of climate change and doing something to reduce carbon, to reduce greenhouse gases.
It's an interesting trio you have behind you in that Risky Business endeavor. Bloomberg, former Republican, now what, independent? Hank Paulson, Republican. Tom Steyer, hedge fund guy, now environmental activist. He must be a Democrat. Yeah. Do you see the politics changing toward movement or not, Kate?
You know, I think the politics are starting to change with events like Sandy, the droughts out in the West in Texas lost an enormous amount of crop and livestock during the drought, with the floods in Colorado. We're starting to see a local response that's very bipartisan or nonpartisan across the country. This is still an extremely partisan issue in Congress, unfortunately. What we're trying to do with this project, which is a very bipartisan project, is to say, you know, look, these guys are all businessmen, and in a normal business, you would do a risk assessment to understand your long-term risks of making, you know, today's investments, today's business decisions. Why aren't we doing that as a country? We think that's an extremely nonpartisan message. It's just, frankly, good sense, and it's what we need to do if we're going to move forward.
Mark Jacobson, look at our energy profile today. And what it is versus what, in your view, it needs to be in order to pull down the climate change reality and risk. Here we got a one-year anniversary. It's a moment to just sit back and think about it. Look at our energy profile right now, Mark. What portion is good? What portion's okay? What portion's just bad?
Well, the good portion is about 4.4% of the U.S. electric power demand is now met by wind power, and a smaller amount is met by solar. Right now, though, most of the electric power demand in the U.S. is met by still fossil fuels, natural gas and coal and some oil, and then transportation is pretty much all oil and its products. And this has to change immediately. We really need a strong, rapid conversion to renewable energy for all purposes. That's wind power, solar power, some geothermal, existing hydroelectric power, and even eventually to tidal wave power. And there's plenty of resource for wind and solar to power the entire world many times over for all purposes. And there's so much less carbon emitted from wind compared with, say, natural gas. There's 1/60th of the carbon emissions and air pollution emissions from wind power per unit energy compared with natural gas. So it's not clear to me why we're even proposing new natural gas plants in the U.S.
Well, isn't it clear because we've got this bounty suddenly with fracking, huge head of steam on drilling in all kinds of new ways for natural gas. It is local. It's in the United States, and it is said to be a lot cleaner than coal. So people, including the president, seem to really be going for it. Mark, what do you think of that?
I think that's a lot of misinformation about the cleanliness of natural gas versus coal first. But let me just address the abundance. I mean, wind power, there's a lot more wind than there is natural gas in terms of potential energy in the United States. And in fact, 50% of all new electric power last year in the U.S. was wind plus solar. It was not natural gas, and wind was number one. Natural gas was number two in terms of new electric power generation. And if you look at the 10 states in the U.S. with the highest penetration of wind, including Iowa and South Dakota, which had 28% of all their electricity last year from wind, the price of electricity in those states went up only 3 cents a kilowatt hour in the last 10 years. All the other states, all the other 40 states, went up 4 cents a kilowatt hour, and Hawaii went up 17 cents a kilowatt hour. So you stabilize prices by putting up wind power. Natural gas, there's an abundance of it now. But that's a temporary abundance. But if you look at the long-term trends of all the fossil fuels, the prices are bound to go up because their fuel costs are not zero. You have to mine and transport and refine all those fuels, whereas wind and solar have zero fuel costs, and so that you'll stabilize prices forever, basically, by converting. In terms of jobs, I mean, any new wind and solar, you have huge amounts of jobs, more jobs per unit energy generated than natural gas. So it's an opportunity cost. You have higher emissions in terms of air pollution. 5,000 people a year die of natural gas processing, mining, transport, the air pollution from it, that is, prematurely in the U.S., and you eliminate all those deaths when you go to wind and solar.
But even after Sandy and everything else we've seen, you know what kind of resistance there is to that all-renewable path. I mean, Kate's got big business guys behind her. You've got very well-intentioned people, no doubt here, Mark Ruffalo, but actor Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert Redford, Scarlett Johansson. Do you see the political will, even given what we've witnessed, and up against the interests of the fossil fuel industries writ large, to make this dramatic change when there's such a head of steam on natural gas right now, Mark?
Well, if you want to address Hurricane Sandy, the first thing you would do was put a huge arrays of offshore wind turbines off the coast of New York, and you'd do the same thing in the Gulf of Mexico to protect places like New Orleans. And we've done scientific study recently to look at what's the impact of large arrays of offshore wind on hurricane dissipation. And not only do you generate normal electric power during the year, because the offshore East Coast is the largest untapped source of wind energy in the entire world, but you dissipate the storm surge and the hurricanes by hurricane wind speeds, the wind speeds by up to 50%.
So it's like a wind block and an energy source all at once.
Yeah, exactly. So why would you spend $30 billion on seawalls off of just one city when you can spend that money generating normal electric power? I mean, seawalls don't generate electricity, so you don't get any money back. And the wind turbines have the same impact of reducing the storm surge and the wind speed while generating electric power year-round and providing electricity to the entire East Coast of the U.S.
Kate Gordon, Mark Jacobson wants to go the whole nine yards, just get off of fossil fuels. We know the many side effects of them, and yet we know the vested interest there and the big economic infrastructure that's been built to support fossil fuels. You know, he's got a pretty fast timetable here. He wants to be converting 100% of all new electricity vehicles to wind, water, solar by 2020. With the wake-up calls that we're getting, do you see that as in the realm of possibility, Kate, or how do you look at it?
Well, I think that under, you know, I love Mark's plan. I think that it would be amazing if we could get there. I think, though, that under current sort of, you know, business decision-making and cost-benefit, it's really understandable why these big oil and gas companies are investing in, for instance, natural gas. There's a lot of federal subsidy for it. It's not particularly regulated. It's exempt from the Clean Water Act. States are slowly regulating, but it's cheaper than it should be, and it's generating enormous profits. It makes sense on the balance sheet for those companies that they're investing in it. What I'm arguing is that we need to get there so that our U.S. balance sheet, our public investment balance sheet, is also rational, where we're actually saying, look, the long-term risk of investing in this stuff, the long-term risk of not shifting over to a lower carbon economy is huge, and that we're going to keep paying those costs as a country. It's not worth it. The cost-benefit analysis is not working right now. But at the moment, you know, there's a lot operating against that. There's an existing infrastructure built on fossil fuels. There's $6 billion a year, I think, in federal subsidies for fossil fuel companies across the board. The renewable energy industries are absolutely – those technologies are getting cheaper and those industries are growing. But they're growing in the face of this massive built-out infrastructure and a lack of any kind of a national energy or climate policy to really support their growth. So I think we've got to get that balance sheet right. We've got to understand those risks, and then we've got to really – think about what kind of national commitment we need to make to move forward.
If that's slow, describe for us what the West Coast states, California, Washington, Oregon, even up into Canada, British Columbia, have just agreed to, and how effective that kind of regional movement can be, Kate.
Well, you know, it's really exciting to watch, actually, what's happening on the West Coast. We saw this on the East Coast, actually, through the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative a few years ago. 9 East Coast states joining together on a regional carbon trading market. The West Coast has been a leader. California has a cap and trade system, a low carbon fuel standard and a renewable energy standard. British Columbia has a carbon tax system. Oregon and Washington, in the middle of those two, don't have carbon systems, but both those governors are really interested in taking action. And what's interesting here is these 4 jurisdictions are coming together to say, look, we're really committed to thinking about the West, you know, thinking about how to move the West Coast forward, even if the national government isn't there yet. We're really committed to pricing carbon, to having low carbon fuel, to moving off of oil, to putting electric vehicles in fleets and on the streets. We're committed to moving that forward. And I think that's exciting, honestly, for a bunch of reasons, not just because I live in California, but also because, you know, this is a different model than sort of top-down federal planning. It's a different model than the UN process to get a global climate deal.
Yep.
It's really a sub-national, sort of jurisdictional, bottom-up, innovative plan. And that's what the U.S. does really well. That's how we innovate. That's how we move forward. So I think it's exciting.
But it's so obviously a global problem. I mean, what are the impact ramifications, Kate, of a region moving alone? Is it just feel good, or is it like, leading the way? Does it have real climate consequences when one region acts alone?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. This is a global problem. In California, we, of course, out here talk a lot about California leadership, but we only produce 1% of the global carbon emissions out here. Mm. On the other hand, we're the ninth largest economy in the world. So I think you have to think about it not from a carbon emissions metric, but actually from a leadership metric. So California has an enormous amount of pull in the U.S. because we're a big economy. We produce a lot. We consume a lot. We have an impact on GDP. The U.S. has an enormous impact on the global economy for the same reason. We are a massive producer, consumer. We're a big player, a big dog in the global economy. So we're not even the top carbon emitter anymore. China has surpassed us.
Yeah.
But China, Canada, Australia, India, a number of countries have said to us in the global deal making, we're not doing anything till you do. You show us, you're telling us we got to reduce our emissions. You start. You go first. So I think U.S. leadership cannot be underestimated as a driver.
We'll look at federal. We're hearing a little on the regional front there. Let's get local as well. Michelle is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Michelle, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm from New Orleans, and we just passed the eight-year mark of Hurricane Katrina, which was a huge wake-up call for us in how we deal with major storms and the impacts of climate change. And, you know, as people know, on the Gulf Coast, energy production is not, you know, considered by some our savior, especially by our political leadership. But then also it's been our demise. The industry has carved up our wetlands, and the salt water intrusion has destroyed our marshes. And that's our main hurricane protection. And so now we're looking at a $50 billion coastal master plan needed to shore up our coastline and to protect our citizens. And some are going to be protected and some of them aren't going to be protected as we move forward with this. So one of the things that, you know, I think that we're looking at is, you know, how can we hold the oil and gas industry partially responsible, not just for the benefits it has for our economy, but also for some of the danger it's put our coastal communities in.
Michelle, you in New Orleans, like the Eastern Seaboard with Sandy, with Katrina, you took the hit. So what about the politics in Louisiana? Because you feel the push-pull right there, right? There's all the money that comes from the fossil fuel energy business, and then you describe the environmental damage at the same time here. 8 years after Katrina, would you describe the Louisiana political profile as very open to change on this front or still resistant, Michelle?
I would say that the political leadership in Louisiana is very resistant to moving off of fossil fuels. You know, a lot of money comes into the state from oil and gas production. And, you know, what some people here recently have been kind of pushing for is maybe holding the oil and gas industry somewhat financially responsible for putting some money back into the state master plan. So that we can, you know, get moving on the process of building up our wetlands, which is, you know, our main source of hurricane protection. Levees are great, but they only go so far. We've
right.
got to slow the storms down before they hit the levees.
Get some money in from the companies. That sounds like it might work in Louisiana political culture. Mark Jacobson, you hear even there in Katrina heartland, that political resistance still there to just the kind of thing you're pushing, Mark.
Yes, there is resistance, but I mean, people can't address things by, for example, converting to electric cars in which you don't have to rely on oil anymore. And also pushing for offshore wind off Louisiana, too, which would protect the coastline as well as generating electric power.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about tackling climate change a year after Superstorm Sandy, changes on the ground, adaptation to threats, and changes maybe in the way we live to address climate change itself. Kate Gordon is with us. She's Executive Director of Risky Business. It's a new project that looks at the economic risks posed by climate change. Michael Bloomberg in there, Hank Paulson, Tom Steyer. Mark Jacobson is with us, co-founder of the Solutions Project. He's pushing and quick right now for ASAP move to 100% renewable energy. That is a tall order, but he says that's what it's going to take. What do you think? Can we go all renewable? What's feasible here? What's necessary? Did Sandy change your thinking, your address, the way you think about the future and what we need to do now? Kate, Mark, lots of response online. John says, we will be remembered as the generation that failed to act to stem environmental catastrophe. We're permanently wrecking the planet so we can enjoy an unsustainably luxurious lifestyle beyond the means of the biosphere to support us. James says, humans can stop climate change like they can stop a Mack truck doing 60 on the highway. And Honest Debate says, what does Sandy even have to do with climate change? Kate, can we go to that last first? You know, sort of challenging the premise that there's a connection here.
Sure. You know, Sandy's actually one of those events that we can pretty definitively tie to climate change. Sandy, as I think Matt said earlier, was not actually a hurricane when it hit New York, but what it had done was caused the seas to go cause the ocean to go to a higher level than ever before, and caused storm surges, which is what flooded Lower Manhattan. Those storm surges happened because the sea level had risen to such an extent already. That's why the damage was as big as it was. So Sandy's an example of, you know, sea level rise combined with hurricanes, combined with just storm extremity, causing that massive damage. We're seeing that more and more. And you know, just to talk about sort of causation here, you often get this comment, well, is it really climate change? You know, we always see weather events. Is this really a climate issue? Increasingly, scientists are starting to analogize to steroid use in baseball. So can you say that one home run from a Barry Bonds, for instance, was due to steroid use? Probably not. There's a bunch of factors in there. But you can say that his home run average was probably due to steroid use. Same with climate change. You can't necessarily point to each individual event, parse it out, pick it apart, but you can say that across the board, frequency, severity are absolutely affected by climate change. In at least half of the events, I think the national the meteorological Bulletin of Meteorological Society says at least half the events, global events last year, were pretty definitively tied to climate change, especially higher temperatures, higher precipitation, and again, severity and frequency of storms. So I like that steroid analogy because I think it really hits home to people.
In Sandy, we had a grand slam. Mark, what about James' comment? Says, you know, we can't stop this. There's so much momentum on it. Like a Mack truck doing 60 on the highway, you can't just hold up your hand and stop it. Let's say you got, I mean, I don't know how to get to 100% renewable. You have a whole plan laid out. If you got that, on what timetable would you want it, and how much of the problem would that address, Mark?
Well, our timetable is that by 2020, we'd have all new sources of electric power, transportation, heating and cooling, and industrial processes as clean renewables. So, for example, electric cars, wind, water, solar, electric power generation, air source and ground source heat pumps for heating and cooling, and also a lot of energy efficiency measures, such that by 2030, you would gradually replace the existing infrastructure, because you'd retire old plants, enhance the retirement rates a little bit, but some of them would naturally retire. 2030, we'd have 80% reduction. And by 2050, we'd be 100% clean energy, no more emissions. Now, in terms of the impact of that, about 40% of global warming today is caused by carbon dioxide, and the rest, about 20%, is by black carbon, which is particulate matter, which has a very short lifetime. So if you eliminated black carbon emissions, you would immediately eliminate about 20% of global warming.
That is
which would
coal particulate up the smokestack and all that.
Like diesel particulate matter from diesel, the smoke, the black smoke that you'd see from diesel exhaust. And that affects the Arctic sea ice is expected to disappear in 15 to 30 years. And that would trigger a tipping point to enhance the rate of warming. So if you can control the black carbon and also methane, which has about a 10 to 12 year lifetime, if you can control those emissions, then you can slow down the loss of the Arctic ice and prevent this tipping point. And CO2 has the longest of all the lifetimes. It has a lifetime of on the order of 40 to 60 years, which means that it doesn't all disappear after 40 to 60 years, but a lot of it goes away. And so you can actually start reversing global warming and the air pollution impact. Well, you'd reduce the air pollution impacts immediately. I mean, keep in mind, air pollution is actually one of the major drivers as well as climate change. 2.5 to 4 million people die every year prematurely. In the U.S., it's 50 to 100,000 a year. And that's about 3 to 7% of our entire GDP is wasted on morbidity and mortality due to air pollution, due to lost work days, lost school days.
But does it not also protect us from some of the warming?
Yeah, in fact, it does. It's ironic that the pollution particles in the air, the ones that are not dark, the light color ones, which are most of them, actually offset or mask half of global warming that's occurring. And this is a problem. This is one reason why you don't want to just reduce the particles. You need to reduce the cooling, what I call the cooling particles. You need to reduce all the gases and the particles simultaneously. That's why you need to change the energy infrastructure to eliminate both greenhouse gas emissions and air pollution particle emissions simultaneously, because that's the only way you can actually phase down the impact of the warming. Otherwise, if you just selectively remove some pollutants, you might actually increase warming, ironically.
But we're talking about phasing down here. Bill in Mount Pulaski, Illinois. Bill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Full disclosure, I'm an environmentalist, have been a member of Greenpeace, 350.org, and I have to tell you, since 2008, my views have shifted quite radically, and I'm awfully, awfully pessimistic. We're now at 400 parts per million CO2, which is the most we've had for 3 million years since the Pliocene. So before human beings were on the planet and back when we didn't have ice caps. And all these plans that I'm hearing, with the exception of your one guest who's talking about a pretty radical shift to renewables, but all the others are talking about this slow, bend-the-curve process. And I'm wondering, isn't it time we admit that that approach has failed, that mainstream environmentalism has failed, and that the capitalist system we've got currently is essentially incompatible with sustainable human life on the planet.
Bill, let us pick it up right there. Kate Gordon, you got some major capitalists on your board, but you hear the plaint there from the committed environmentalist who's losing hope.
I do, and I understand it. I think that especially watching these storms and the frequency of these events and seeing the damage, it is extremely hard to stay optimistic. But, you know, I honestly think, I think we do need a shift in our energy systems, but we need that to happen within. We need people to agree with that. We need decision makers to agree with that. You know, I'm encouraged by the fact in some ways that all politics are local, all responses are local, climate change is local. You know, we have people like Senator Bob Singer in New Jersey, a Republican on the coast, saying he would support and push for a national carbon tax if it meant that there were revenues to help rebuild his region. We've got Governor Kasich in Ohio campaigning for governor on a policy to get rid of renewable energy policy in the state and changing his mind when Toledo businessmen came to talk to him about solar panels. We have my home state of Wisconsin, where the Libertarian Party has come out in support of distributed solar rooftop programs and wind because they want to get off the grid. These are local folks with local responses that are moving in the same direction Mark is moving. I just think we need to remember that that decision makers around the country are going to need to come to this same going to need to start accepting the science, understanding the risk, and coming to these same conclusions. We do have a political system that requires that kind of democratic process in action, and I think we need to work with that.
If Bill is right, he's losing hope about doing something dramatic and soon enough to stop more of this damage. If some of the damage is baked in the cake, maybe some bad damage is baked in the cake coming at us. What about adaptation? How big a part of the formula for how we deal in this century do you see that being? And what kind of adaptation? I mean, they're talking about seawalls in New York and who knows what all. Where do you see that going, Kate?
Well, you know, I think it's a continuum. So just like our responses to other kinds of risk, you know, I know the risks of smoking, for instance. It's a continuum how I deal with that. I don't smoke, for instance, but I also work out. I also have health insurance. Those things are along a continuum. So I'm adapting to that risk. I'm also planning to mitigate that risk. I think it's the same thing with climate change. We absolutely, cities and states in particular and individuals have to adapt. These events are happening today. They're getting more severe. Whoever wrote in about climate change as a Mack truck is in some ways right. Some of this is baked in already. So we have to do adaptation and we have to be smart, but we also have to think ahead. So New York, for instance, is starting to think about changing its planning and zoning maps to take rising sea levels into account. That's critically important. We need to plan ahead by decentralizing our energy systems. We can't have all these centralized power stations. We need to start putting things out in a more decentralized way so that we don't have these giant blackouts that affect huge regions of the country. We should be thinking about making those new energy systems as low carbon or zero carbon as possible. That's planning ahead. So I think it's a continuum. We need to understand the risk, and we need to plan. We need to react to that risk with what, you know, short-term responses, but also thinking ahead to, look, how do we minimize it over the long term?
Let's go to Magnolia, Delaware, and Leslie. Leslie, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I do believe that we really do need to put the effort into the research of being able to re-innovate material. Because of natural disasters in the United States, there's a lot of material. And because of the education of the United States, there's tons of programs, especially in engineering. I think that we need to have a more eclectic outlook of what type of engineering is out there, what's available to us. We do need to put the research in. And even though it's a big economic cost, I think we also do need to encourage people to volunteer.
Leslie, what do you think? We're going to engineer defenses against storm surge, let's say, or engineer a change in our energy structure so we produce less climate change? Which one?
I definitely do believe we need both.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely do need different materials to re-innovate material for withstanding natural disasters. You know, that's a stronger material. And
yep.
We do have lots of materials here in the United States, especially from the damage. That will create jobs. But not only, as I said before, if we get people to volunteer, that might help with the cost.
Leslie, I appreciate your call. Yeah, a lot of materials, though, you know, a lot of houses ended up like toothpicks after Sandy. I don't know what you do with that exactly, but clear it away. But maybe re-engineer, find stronger ways. Thanks for your call. Asa in Keysville, New York. Asa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I'm a grass-fed beef farmer in Keysville, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm calling. I originally got into farming because of my environmental views, local food, decrease infrastructure, fuel costs, that sort of thing. But I've, you know, as I've gotten into it, I've learned that good rotational grass-fed beef grazing can actually fix carbon in the soil. And, you know, I'm a small farmer. I've got 18 cows, but we eat a lot of beef in this country. And right now, all those beef cows are being fed corn, which which leads them to produce methane, which is, I don't know what percent that contributes to global warming.
It's not small. So do you think how do you feel when you're out there with your grass-fed cattle, Asa, do you feel like I'm saving the planet, or do you feel like I'm one little guy trying to do something and maybe we're going to hell in a handbasket at the same time?
I'm trying to make a living, trying to make a living as a farmer,
and,
you know, I'm trying to take care of my animals and feed my community and myself good food. But I know that beef is big business in this country, and corn is big business in this country. And a lot of agriculture is big business.
And you're taking your step. Our time is short. I appreciate your call, Asa. Mark, not everybody can put up a giant, wind array or solar array or hydropower, but people are thinking in their own small ways. Does that add up to enough, or does it have to be systemic power source change?
Yeah, it helps. People can do things in their own homes. They can retrofit their homes to reduce energy loss. They can use LED light bulbs instead of incandescents to reduce energy use significantly. They can go to electric cars, a lot of energy efficient appliances. People can volunteer and help at the grassroots levels. They can join the Solutions Project, which involves lots of people in educating the public about energy and actually implementing solutions.
Kate, we've got new legislation coming out next year on power production and emissions in this country. Describe that for us, and what do you expect when that heads toward coming on stream here? What we've talked about already, new power plants, cleaning them up, but this is getting into existing plants. What do you see coming, Kate?
Sure. It's actually not legislation, but an administrative rule from the Environmental Protection Agency.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's you threw me off for a second. I was
sorry.
Like, we do.
EPA executive Gina McCarthy and all that.
Exactly. So what the EPA is doing, they're acting on a Supreme Court decision, EPA versus Massachusetts, in which the Supreme Court decided the EPA was right that carbon is a pollutant and needs to be regulated. So the EPA has started to regulate it much more than before. We already saw a draft rule on new power plants. So new plants that are built are going to have to meet a pretty strict standard in terms of how much carbon they actually kind of cycle back and sequester or keep in the ground. We're next June going to see draft regulations on existing power plants that will hold them to high standards as well. There's a big active debate about those standards and about whether, you know, the U.S. is technologically kind of ready to figure out how to capture and store carbon, whether we're ready to meet those higher standards. I tend to have a lot of faith in U.S. business and in our ability to innovate. We have done a great job in the past of reacting to new standards like the ozone layer standards with new innovations and new technologies. I think we are doing a great job of moving toward alternatives like Mark's talking about.
So, how about a backlash, though? When that draft comes out, that draft proposal, what do you expect?
Well, I expect to see a backlash for sure. There's been a backlash every time we've seen new regulations on the existing energy system. So there was a huge backlash around the Montreal Protocol and the ozone layer standards too. But we innovated and we got past it. So I think there'll be a backlash, but I also think that, you know, American business has the ability to really move forward here.
If we're moving forward at, I don't know what, 16 miles an hour, what speed do we need to be at on these changes, Kate, to really be realistic here?
Oh, that's a tough one. We need to be going a lot faster, both on adaptation and resilience and on long-term planning. And a huge part of that's, frankly, just accepting the science, moving on from the climate change debate, understanding the risks and taking action.
We're trying to get this buggy up on the highway in gear and up to action speed. Kate Gordon, it's great to have you with us this hour, Executive Director
Thanks
of
so
Risky
much, Tom.
Business. Thank you, Kate, for your time from San Francisco.
Thank you, Tom.
And Mark Jacobson with the Solutions Project. Check it out. Joined us today from Stanford, California. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for all your calls and input. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.